Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is the Syracuse-based artist, activist, and educator, Sharif Bey. Since May, he's had a 20-year retrospective show of his work at the Everson Museum, titled Facets. Mr. Bey has won numerous awards for his work, and his work can be found in the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh, the Smithsonian Museum of American Art, and the Renwick Gallery in Washington, D.C., among other locations. He's also a professor in arts education and teaching and leadership in Syracuse University's College of Visual and Performing Arts and its School of Education. Professor Bey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for making the time to talk with me. So, first of all, rather than me describing it, why don't you start by telling our listeners a little bit about the mediums that you use and what you've tried to express and or perhaps represent through your artwork?
Well, a mid-career retrospective, and by the way, it actually goes back to 91, so it's even more than 20 years.
Ah, okay, 30, yeah.
Yeah. It's a 30-year retrospective. It tells a pretty long story. So to try to encapsulate all that work in just a sentence or two, I would probably want to talk about one of the central themes of the exhibition,
okay,
which is primarily about my kind of earliest fascinations with the potter's wheel. I started out working on a potter's wheel when I was 15 years old. And shortly thereafter, I was working in a program called the Manchester Craftsman's Guild in Pittsburgh, and they had an amazing national visiting artists program. And at a very, very early age, I got to see contemporary ceramic artists, many of whom were college professors themselves, brought their stories by way of a Thursday evening lecture or Friday afternoon workshop. As well as an exhibition and a hands-on collaborative experience with many of the high school students. So I got to see lots of trajectories, and I got hooked on the wheel, and that kind of became my my home away from home, working on the wheel at the center, and kept me out of trouble and kept me focused, and eventually took me for a 30-year ride. I mean, talking about three college degrees without a penny out of my own pocket, took me around the world many times over. And it started with my commitment to that aspect of the craft. So the exhibition focuses on, some really modest cookie jars and teapots. And it talks about how that frames the exhibition, because the sculptures in the exhibition, some of which are over 5 foot tall, are also, in many ways, honoring or reflecting on my formative education as a potter. So there are lots of things I learned from pottery that transferred into my education as a sculptor in art school, later pursuing my master's and again, studying in different parts of the world. So one primary theme is certainly the vessel. And not just the vessel ergonomically and spatially, but also the vessel as a metaphor. And that's something also that translates into, other works. Even the works on the wall are made from, volumetric objects that I consider to be vessels in their own right. And of course, the surfaces as well. And some of the language that I learned from, more ornate pottery later translates into the sculpture. So I liken myself to a sculptor who looks to the traditions of pottery, wherefore we have a lot of potters who say, I like the forms and the lexicons of forms that stem from sculpture. I kind of look at it the other way around.
Yeah, I want to ask you about one of those sculptures in a little bit, but I'll just say now too, the objects on the wall are just simply beautiful. You say that you were raised in, and I'm quoting here from something that I read about you earlier, an anti-imperialist household. Tell me what that means to you and how it impacted your work.
Well, I mean, I think that when I was a kid, I was raised with an acute awareness that there was a missing narrative in media. So we turn on the television, and you know, when I was a kid, I mean, I'm nearly 50 years old, and I'm considered to have an old soul because I have a brother who's 20 years older than me. My parents had, you know, 12 children. So, and I'm one of the younger ones. So I had the benefit of the visual culture of decades earlier than my own. And I would see, you know, Tarzan and Tonto and Liz Taylor as Cleopatra and Christopher Reeves as Superman. And I was, you know, essentially taught that there was some skewed historical representations, and there was a missing narrative, and I was taught that there's a multiplicity of beauty in the world that's not represented in our American media. And I was essentially raised to kind of seek alternatives and to question the representation of the protagonists or the happily ever after story. You know, who's missing in these stories? And it varies across the board. So, you know, and also alternative media. You know, I had an uncle who was an avid listener to shortwave radios, and you know, when I was a kid. So he always had alternative media and alternative news stories that you know, so for me, you know, I realized that while first of all, from a you know, emerging political identity, that was important to understand that, you know, maybe not everything you're being fed is good for you or true, but also from a creative point of view, you know, because I was taught that there were gaps, but we didn't always have the answers either. So It's missing in this story. And we were literally not allowed to play with white dolls as kids. You know, they were considered to be kind of the antithesis of self-hate when you're playing with characters who don't reflect you in any way. You know, what is the psychodynamic, you know, damage of that? And studies have later proven that. And my parents were, and my grandparents were on the cusp of that. They knew that, you know, maybe it was a problem if there weren't any brown dolls. Maybe you shouldn't play with any dolls if that was the only option. And all the heroes had blonde hair and blue eyes. And there weren't any heroes that looked like me, or there weren't any brown heroes. So anyway, what started to happen is my brother and I would oftentimes, you know, make our own stories. You know, well, if you can't tell the story of Star Wars without Luke, right? So who do you sub for Luke? You know, so we would do that. We couldn't buy Luke, so we would sub for Luke. And as a result of those kinds of omissions and compensations, you know, we create our own stories. And that's a beautiful thing.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Syracuse-based artist and educator Sharif Bey, who has a major show currently running at the Everson Museum titled Facets. So I was curious, as you put together this 30-year retrospective, and obviously it gave you an occasion, I suppose, to reflect back on your work and its trajectory, were there things about your path as an artist that were revealed to you in this process that maybe you weren't as aware of before when you sort of saw it all there in front of you and thought about it in those terms?
It was emotional. It was heartfelt. It was overwhelming. It was literally, there were over 100 pieces in this exhibition spanning 30 years. So it was like a reunion of old friends. But also when you make objects, you know, they serve as placeholders and mementums and souvenirs. And, you know, what was really overwhelming and emotional about it is I think about the people who were affiliated with the times in which I made those objects, and also the programs that were designed to support kids like me. And the sad thing is that, you know, many of those mentors and teachers have passed on. And the really unfortunate thing that occurs to me is a lot of those kinds of programs don't exist anymore for young people. And as an educator, I've come to learn how difficult it is and how cost prohibitive and logistically prohibitive it is to to put together something like a school bus field trip for kids anymore. So one of the things that was revealed to me was how lucky I was as a kid to benefit from the kinds of programs that I did in the 80s. I mean, I've gone to countless pre-college programs, museum programs, summer camps. I mean, I went away. Once I kind of found out this is what I wanted to do, I was smart enough to know that all I had to do was ask the people who I admired how to get where they are. You know, that's something I question that young people, they kind of feel like maybe they have their own way of cracking the code, you know, with social media and going viral and this, that, and the other. But when I was a kid, there were lots of people I admired and people who achieved things that I wanted to achieve. And I simply asked them, how do I get there? And they said, okay, work hard and go to college and then get your master's and build your studio. I said, oh, I'll do those things. Hmm. And it, you know, it's really, I was literally, I guess we're all kind of given that roadmap. We don't always read it, but I was lucky or smart or blessed. We can call it whatever, but that's basically what I did. I had a lot of people I admired and they were putting bricks down and I was stepping right onto those pavers.
Now, I did want to ask you about one of your works in particular. Mm-hmm. Many of the works in the exhibition I found really quite arresting. And there's one in particular that I have to say has haunted me in a good way. And it's one of your figures that, and I'm just going to describe it very basically. So I apologize if I'm not doing justice to it, but it's one of your figures and it's riddled with nails and it's got on its body many heads, which look to me anyway, as if they might be in distress in some way. I mean, could you tell me about that particular work? That's the one that has stayed most with me.
You're talking about the piece that's titled Soul Collector. One of the challenges with works that stem from different cultural historical orientations is that we kind of take them, we interpret them from a very specific point of view that sometimes has, you know, baggage. We see this and we assume this and we interpret this as such. But there is a specific kind of visual culture stemming from West African sculpture. And that is very much of interest to me. I'm also interested in the very thing we're talking about. I'm interested in object as fetish. And I'm interested in kind of playing with Western conjecture and playing with how we respond to the spoils of colonization. So I play on that. I've talked about my interest. That's kind of the second pillar of the thematic pillar of this exhibition. I talked about pottery. The second thing is my interest in West African sculpture, but also my interest in the decontextualized colonial object, post-colonial object. So I'm those objects are specifically responding to West African Nkisi Kongo power figures. Okay. And the tradition of those figures is about them being impaled objects. And the thing that's interesting to me is lots of times people imagine them or think of them as being like, I mean, I guess when they're made, they are impaled. But we see the aftermath. We don't see the verb. We see the noun of art in this case, right? You see the 100 works that I made. You don't see me making them. You don't know what we're thinking. You don't know what they're stemming from in those cases. But I think of these things in some cases as things that are protruding from them as opposed to things that are coming into them. So, you know, we don't look at a porcupine and say, oh, that must hurt, right? It's kind of intrinsic to what it is. So I kind of play on that. But in the case of this object, the Soul Collector, I don't particularly think of it as being anguished. Sometimes I think of the nails as ornamental, much like some of the sgraffitos and or patterns in some of the other works. I think of the, you know, while I'm looking at the history of Nkongos or the Nkisi figures rather, as ceremonial objects that have a specific purpose, that are about affirming oaths or their power figures, their figures of protection. You know, there is a specific meaning in that cultural context, what it means to impale an object with a nail, but also started to think about the repetition of these nails in some of these West African sculptures and how beautiful they are, even out of their cultural or ceremonial context. And those particular pieces in the show are responding to that. And the heads are literally that. My niece actually is 5 years old, and she came to this show on like a family day. And, you know, it's just so interesting how we respond from different perspectives. And she says, "Uncle Sharif, why did you put the babies on spikes?" So she's, you know, she's thinking I'm a tormentor as well, right? But, you know, there's something very, you know, dreamlike about, you know, these kind of heads that are kind of levitating on there. But I'm thinking of it as a keeper of spirits.
Okay.
And not like a torturer or a monstrous figure.
Hmm. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Sharif Bey. He's a Syracuse-based artist and educator, and currently he has a major retrospective exhibition at the Everson Museum of Art, and it's titled Facets. Now, Sharif, that, as you well know, the Everson is known for ceramics. I was just curious if that played any role either in your physical relocation to Syracuse, your decision to come here and live and be at Syracuse University, or was that just serendipity?
A little bit of both, actually. It's really interesting. I talked about me being, you know, a young kid who sought out people who were achieving what I wanted to achieve. And I essentially established a network at a pretty early age. And many of the people in my network were college professors, one of whom was or is David McDonald. And David McDonald taught at Syracuse University from 1971 to, I want to say, 2007. So, but at this time, you know, in my mind, from Pittsburgh and not doing a whole lot of research, Syracuse, I knew about the Everson, and I knew about Syracuse basketball. And I just thought Syracuse was a school for rich kids and a school I couldn't get into. So I didn't even bother applying to school here, although I did want to study with David McDonald. But Syracuse was on my radar just because he was here. Okay. And I knew about the Everson, but there was a lot of trepidation about the possibility of me being successful here. So I passed up Syracuse, not thinking I can get in as a undergrad student. And definitely not as a grad student. I think the application was even a little bit cost prohibitive for me. But it nonetheless, it kept Syracuse on the radar for me. And I kept in touch with David McDonald, I mean, since I was 15 years old.
And now you're on the faculty. So I love the way that ended. I'm just curious whether living in Syracuse has influenced your more recent work in any ways that you could identify.
In a very interesting way, and this is not so content driven, but one of the things that kind of circumstantially, talk about serendipity at its best, I came to Syracuse, and there's a correction I need to add, is I'm no longer on the faculty of the School of Education as of January this year.
Okay, just VPA then.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I came here primarily as an art educator. And in the conventional sense, in most schools, that means you're the person with the clipboard and a tie and your publisher parish and you're editing and, you know, maybe supervising teachers in the schools, but it's an academic appointment. And I was uniquely appointed here. And this is one of the things that brought me here is I was given an opportunity to be duly appointed to do and or, and I was very much supported back then, especially under the support of Doug Bicklin, who was then, Dean of School of Ed and very much an art enthusiast. So they, you know, Doug kind of got me and you know, I really appreciated the fact that I was supported as a physical creator, although I had an academic appointment. But anyway, it took a while for me to kind of gain the acceptance that I sought amongst the visual arts faculty, because I didn't really come here as an artist. So I was like writing and publishing and making these things in my basement that very few people knew about. And they later kind of started to gain national attention, and it became almost hard to ignore, the impact I was having outside of Syracuse. And then more and more I started teaching ceramics and visual arts in Syracuse. But the serendipity I wanted to share is I started to fire more and more of my work alternatively. And when I say that, I burn a fireplace probably 6 months out of the year in Syracuse. So I started to use that as part of my practice. And I started to kind of do these short alternative firings in my fireplace. I lived on East Genesee Street when I first moved here. We converted our koi pond into an alternative kiln where I could fire outside. So these kind of, I will call them indigenous firing processes. Unfortunately, we refer to them as alternative firings in the contemporary ceramics world, but I do a lot of firing and a lot of kind of unconventional firing in my fireplace and in the koi pond. And it really came out of, well, it's so damn cold here, why not?
Yeah, you're in a good place to burn a fireplace 6 months out of the year.
It just kind of became my thing.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the artist Sharif Bey. I've got a political question for you now. For a variety of reasons, the Black Lives Matter movement, the presidency of Donald Trump, changing demographics in the United States, among others, the issue of identity and different identities has become more front and center, I think, in our political dialogues. And it's certainly, I think, one of the centerpieces of the dialogues going on in the Democratic Party, for sure. Do you think that that has raised interest in your work, given some of the themes that it deals with? And is there something that you want your work to say to those political conversations?
Hopefully I can do justice to this in the time that we have.
Yeah, I know. It's a big question.
We should have led with that, Grant.
Sorry.
I think that we're at a time now. I can remember a time in my life. I mean, I've been lecturing about my work for decades. And that was a conversation I used to kind of abbreviate. And not because I wasn't proud of it. I just didn't think that there was a reception in having a more meaningful conversation about cultural or even political identity, right? And I think that now we're at a time where people are more inclined to unpack that. You know, the indigenous communities are more verbal. African-American communities from the African diaspora are more inclined to say, this is, I'm going to own this history. And I want you to understand, or at least work to understand, that I'm a product of this history, this fragmented history, this history that stemmed a certain political motivation, what it is. And we're also in a time, even the work that I was making, the more ornate work, it's a little bit, I'll say, safer. You know, I'm talking about decorated cookie jars and things. It has a certain quote unquote cultural flair. Mm-hmm. And I know people who are making, I don't want to trivialize anyone's work, but like stylistically comparable work, and they're selling like hotcakes. Work that I was struggling to move 25 years ago, people are, with the support of social media, and I have 50,000 followers, and before the kiln even cools, it's sold out. So there is a reception, for kind of culturally visible work. You know, I have works that are much more charged, especially symbolically. Like one of the pieces in the show that the Everson purchased a couple of years ago is one from my Protest Shield series. So I'm specifically responding in to the things that you just kind of foreshadow, responding to the riots, the Black Lives Matter movement, but also kind of hearkening back to kind of to the symbolism of the Black fist and integrating that into the kind of radial patterns that I'm kind of known for. So what is the relationship between me being a potter who became a sculptor, who's a student of the world history of art, who's living at the time in 2020 and then into the pandemic, you know, and you know, and all of these milestones. I mean, one of the things that the curator was mentioning, you know, this show spans Y2K, 9/11, a major recession, right? There's been some, the pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, and not to mention, you know, Tamir Rice, George Floyd, I can go on and on. But there's been some significant historically significant events that transpired in the last 30 years. Now, I want to say one other thing, that in addition to that, we have what a friend of mine, Paul Briggs, refers to as the contemplative object. So sometimes I'm overtly responding, and sometimes I'm taking refuge. Sometimes I'm into this kind of meditative dance that is somehow trying to find peace despite the turmoil outside the door. So, but nonetheless, it's embodied. So, you know, a lot of the work is made since the pandemic that's in that show. I mean, there's a lot of things from 2020 to now that are in that show and that are responding to the landscape that you described.
We only have a couple seconds left, literally, but I wanted to give you a chance at the end just to give a couple sentences on this. You've already spoken to it in a way, but do you have any specific and short advice for new artists at any age who are starting out?
Well, my dream and hope is that people stay humble enough to listen, you know, ask questions, but focus on keen listening, and don't be so pressured by becoming original. There are so many wonderful legacies and traditions to be a part of while you work to figure out who you are. Honor those histories by making.
Great. That was Sharif Bey, and his exhibition titled Facets runs at the Everson Museum until August 14th. Sharif, this has been fascinating, and I want to thank you not only for your work, but for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Grant. It's been great.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.